I, George Walker Bush.
I, George Walker Bush.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will to the best of my ability.
And will to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
Well, those words begin a second term for President George W. Bush. That was last week's inauguration. Chief Justice Rehnquist swearing in the president for his second term. We're going to be talking about that second term. What are the issues that are facing the president for the next 4 years and the country as well? Dr. Jeff Walls joins us. He's a regular guest here on Issues, Etc. And in the second half hour of this last hour of Issues, Etc., Bill Beckman will join us from Illinois Right to Life to talk about pro-life legislation in Illinois, what's on the agenda, and Pam Fichter from Missouri Right to Life will join us to talk about pro-life legislation in Missouri. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Jeff Walls is Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. Jeff, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be back.
First of all, what did you make of the president's inaugural speech? That's what everybody's talking about.
Yeah, it was a wonderful time. I'm teaching a winterim course here, a three-week course that just ended. And it was a special time for the students and I to gather and really hear a couple of powerful messages from the president. I guess I was struck especially by the broad and the wide-ranging rhetorical flourishes, the emphasis on liberty and freedom and bringing certain American values and ideals to the world. It was in many ways very, very unapologetic. Yet it was also a speech that suggested that, you know, there are universal values and America believes in these universal values. The thing where, of course, we'll have to see where things shake out is exactly where the details might fill in. As one says, the devil's in the details at times, and certainly that could be the case with how we actually implement this kind of global democratic process.
What is a presidential inauguration all about? My daughter was asking about this. You know, she said, I thought he was elected back in November. What's this all about? Why do we wait so long before the second term really begins?
Yeah. Yeah, a couple of things. One is we do, as you said, vote back in November. However, it's not until December when the Electoral College delegates actually go to their respective state capitals and then cast their official ballots for president. And then we have a few more weeks really to give the new president, if there is one, or the returning president, in this case President Bush, time to refocus and really time, as we've seen with Bush, to rearticulate some agendas, some goals he has in mind, and to consider some cabinet positions which he needs to fill in. And like other second-term presidents, Bush has had to fill in a number of cabinet posts. And so it's really a time for transition and a time for adjustment. And you get the new members of Congress into town and the 109th Congress initiated, and everyone can kind of start from a fresh footing.
Second terms, at least in recent history, and they are rather rare, but second terms usually prove pretty treacherous for the presidents who serve them. And we need to think no farther back than the most recent second-term presidents. Is this something that's just a rule of history, or should President Bush expect something a little different?
Yeah, that's a good point, Todd. Not necessarily a rule of history. I think you're right. If we look back, of course, to President Clinton and his scandal issues with Monica Lewinsky, we look back to Ronald Reagan, his second term with Iran-Contra. We look back to Richard Nixon and Watergate. So those three circumstances, to me, were more suggestions of a scandal that could have occurred in a first or a second term. What we do see looking further back historically would not be scandals necessarily that would arrive at a president's door, but a president trying to do difficult things, trying to make tough decisions when the electorate and especially his own members of Congress of his party and the other party recognize that his power really is waning, and really a president has perhaps a year, at most 2 years out of this 4-year term to really make something happen before that lame duck status really kicks in, and people know even more full well that this president's time is limited.
Is that time shortened all the more by the fact that our presidential elections are 2-year events now?
Yes. They're 2-year events, or even, as you've heard, almost 4-year events. So much, to my mind, unfortunate speculation already about 08, and I'm just getting ready to enjoy the next 4 years before the next election. So yeah, there's this perpetual electoral cycle that kicks in, and you know, some members of Congress might be thinking about voting on issues coming up, not on perhaps what's at times best for the country or best for a president, but what might benefit his or her own electoral or even presidential aspirations.
You mentioned filling cabinet positions. The president, of course, has had a number of resignations, which is typical of many second-term presidents. Which ones are most important for him to fill, and what are the likely prospects of him getting those done in short order, getting his cabinet back up and running, and starting into the second term fully loaded?
Yeah, I think he will start fully loaded. There was a little controversy. There was a hope in the Bush camp that Condoleezza Rice, the designate for Secretary of State, taking over from Colin Powell, there was some hope that she could be approved or confirmed already last week, perhaps even on the day of the inauguration. The Democrats wanted to have a greater hearing on that, so that's going to yet continue to occur. That's the key one. There's really not much doubt that she will be confirmed. It came out of the committee 16-2 in her favor, and so there's not much doubt that she will or will not be confirmed. She will be confirmed, but it's just a matter of trying to get his people in place as soon as possible. A few other cabinet members have already been confirmed via voice vote, Ag Secretary Johans and a few others. So some of these, I guess you might think, lower-level cabinet posts, while they're not as prominent as certainly a Secretary of State or an Attorney General, Gonzalez, certainly they're also important as well. But I don't see any of these appointments being scuttled. Perhaps Alberto Gonzalez as Attorney General will be the toughest vote, but again, I don't see him failing the Senate confirmation process.
And I guess what I'm wondering about here is this a test, at least initially, of the president's sway with the legislature, the ease of the confirmations of his own cabinet? These are discretionary positions that the president alone decides on.
Yeah, I think Todd, to a point, it is a test of the sway of the president. Although, in this case, it seems to me the Democrats have a number of different issues that they've said they'd like to oppose, and I think they're going to kind of pick their spots here. I think they recognize that trying to scuttle a Gonzalez a nomination or a Rice nomination probably won't, number one, work, and number two, won't curry very much favor with the public. So. It can be a test of a president's sway, but there are a number of Democrats, too, who've come out and said, you know, well, I don't perhaps think all of these nominees are perfect. It is the president's discretion to name whom he wants to these positions. So a test, but perhaps a mild test at best.
The biggest issue, simply in terms of its immediacy, that will face this president are either successful or unsuccessful elections in Iraq at the end of this month. How crucial will this prove to be kind of a tone-setting issue for the president's second term?
Yeah, the crucial thing to me is the appearance or at least the functioning of some democratic process ASAP during and after that election. And as we've read and as we know, these are extraordinarily not only historic but unusual elections in many ways. And to me, it's not the raw number of votes that will really matter, but it's the Iraqis who are quite literally risking life and limb going to the polls and not knowing exactly who's running, not knowing at this point necessarily where they're going to vote, being told in some cases not to bring vehicles for fear of bombs in vehicles. So there's so much uncertainty. But if amid that, if at least there can be some semblance of a democratic process with some kind of a minimal level of violence, then I think it'll certainly be an endorsement, at least initially, of the Bush policy in the electoral phase of Iraq.
What other major issues are, at least according to the president's recent speeches and press pronouncements, what are on the front burner for the president in the next 4 years?
Yeah, certainly the front burner, Todd, looking more domestically. Social Security reform, which I'll talk about, is going to be a huge one. Tax reform or reforming the tax code is going to be huge. There have been discussions about energy reform, discussions about making some of the tax cuts of 01 and 03 permanent. But clearly Bush is putting a lot of his political capital on a very hot-button issue of Social Security. And you know, while I certainly admire his ambition and his, I think, legitimate and genuine yearning to change a system or at least to improve a system, that whether it's in crisis or whether it's in difficult shape, however we define it, that's going to be a very tough nut to crack. Just looking at what might work in both the House and the Senate, because even though the president does have, unlike some of these other presidents in the second term, does have healthy majorities in the House and the Senate of his own party, certainly the party is not on the same page when it comes to how to reform Social Security. For example, in the House, there's been discussions, well, we definitely need these individual accounts. Let people now or younger people take some of their Social Security and invest it. That could run into great difficulty in the Senate. Others in the Senate have said, well, let's think about raising the payroll tax, the kind of the ceiling up to which people pay Social Security on their income. And while that may gain votes in the Senate, it may lose votes in the House. So it's going to be difficult to really find some kind of a balancing act between these two chambers on such a contentious issue.
So you talk about a balancing act. The president is recognized across party lines for being kind of the consummate compromiser and being able to work the issue to his favor, at the very least work the issue to his favor. Do you think that kind of ability will transfer to even more contentious issues beyond Social Security, like life issues for the president in the second term?
Todd, I think it could. I think what might happen, again, the life issue could take many different forms, but if we're talking the life issue from the perspective of a Supreme Court justice nominee or nominees, for example, that's where, though Bush is well known and rightly, I think, respected for his pragmatic skills, that's where it's going to be difficult, I think, in some ways, because I think some of the Democrats will go along or at least try and find some common ground, perhaps on Social Security, perhaps on an energy policy that might be difficult as well, or maybe even tax reform. But one of the, I guess, holy grails, you might say, of the Democratic Party has been its pro-choice plank, which has been in some review now after this 2004 election. So if Bush is to nominate for a Supreme Court justice position, someone who is fairly openly pro-life, things could get fairly interesting.
So in that respect, how will the loyal opposition, and this generally speaking, the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. how do you expect them to modify their approach, how have you observed them already modifying their approach after some of the surprises that they met with in November's election?
Yeah, good question, Todd. There's really a struggle here, too. There's a voting process to be commenced soon to choose the next chair of the Democratic Party, and there's the one wing of the party, at the expense of overgeneralizing, that has said we need to kind of rediscover some key Democratic ideals that would include the pro-choice ideal, that would include kind of the working person's ideal, and this would be a Howard Dean kind of wing of the party, the former Vermont governor who ran for president. Now, others are saying we need somebody who's more pragmatic and, from religious perspective, someone perhaps who's not as ironclad pro-choice as others might be. And a name such as Tim Romer, who was a member of the 9/11 Commission, a former Indiana member of Congress has been mentioned. Whether he has enough support to win the chair is a question, but he's one who has at least said we need as a party, as a Democratic Party, not to be so ironclad, and we need to at least look at a party that allows more gray area on the pro-choice issue and allows perhaps even pro-life members into the party. So, yeah, there's quite a bit of behind the scenes, I think, angst and hand wringing about exactly which way to take the party and what form or what equation the pro-life issue would be in that.
What do you think the political impact would be if the Democratic National Committee did kind of, you know, take a gamble and select former Indiana Congressman Tim Romer, pro-life, devout Roman Catholic, as its chair?
For the Democrats, I think it would be a masterstroke in many ways, because there is, the research suggests, a group of Christians out there and a group of religious people out there who are pro-life, but certainly also subscribe to some of the other Democratic tenets on the environment, on poverty, and on other issues separate from the abortion issue. And I guess the fear, again, among some Democrats is, well, what about the hardcore pro-choice folks? Are they going to leave the party? And I don't sense that there's really anywhere for them to go at this point short of forming their own party. So somebody like Romer, who could bring a fresh voice, who's not an Eastern elite, who's from the Midwest, who could, I think, appeal to, as you suggested, a different kind of constituency, might actually serve the party quite well.
We're talking about Bush's second presidential term with Dr. Jeff Waltz, Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin, during this half hour of Issues Etc. in about 15 minutes. We're going to discuss pro-life legislation in both Illinois and in Missouri. Bill Beckman of Illinois Right to Life will be our guest, and then right after that conversation, Pam Fichter of Missouri Right to Life will join us to round off the program. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. One of the big issues that kind of bubbled up and then faded away, at least from the public eye, right in the middle and near the end of the presidential elections, was gay marriage. And it was the subject of many a referendum during the election cycle. Is it going to see the light of day during a second Bush term?
Good question. At this point, I don't think so. What seems to be happening, a couple of things. One is, I just saw a list, you may have seen this, of the top 10 Senate initiatives for this coming legislative session, and any kind of an amendment on gay marriage was not on that list. So I think one reality is the votes probably are not there. Last time, I believe, there were 48 in the affirmative for a ban on gay marriage constitutionally. So I don't know politically if the votes are there. And then secondly, what seems to be happening, too, is a sense of let's see exactly where the courts go and what the courts rule on this. And if, you know, if the rulings come down in such a way that the president or leaders in the House or the Senate, Republican leaders, feel this issue needs to be picked up again, perhaps as the 2006 elections roll around, then that's a possibility as well. So I think it's mostly bowing to a sense of political reality, and that I think the statement's been made that that the party and the president believe strongly in a man and a woman in a marriage, and that the public and the party knows this is their position.
Well, the president has pledged to support an amendment like this. Not very specific, but he will support it. But there's a big difference between a president simply supporting and actually going out and working the halls of Congress in order to see something happen. It sounds like you don't expect President Bush to take this up as one of his lobbying positions with his legislative colleagues.
Yeah, I just don't at this point, Todd, given, as you said, some of the other issues on the table. And yes, the president, as Bush has said, does have capital, and he will use the capital. But if Bush wants to work on Social Security and anything beyond that with tax reform or tort legal reform, I think he's going to need all the political capital he can. And this kind of reminds me in some ways of 81, of course, a different issue. I believe it was 81 when Reagan came in and there was a vote in the Senate on a prayer, school prayer amendment, which was defeated, that would have allowed prayer again in public schools. And some on the right, religious right, were critical of Reagan because they felt he as well, perhaps at that time didn't use all of the political capital or muscle that he could have on that issue. I think the Reagan folks said, well, that may be true, but we just didn't have the votes anyway, so we wanted to use our capital on more economic issues, which was the driving kind of mantra during those tough economic times.
One could not watch the inauguration, in particular the swearing-in ceremony, without noticing, even more so than the president himself, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who was frail looking, a man of some stature, looking rather frail. Of course, his illness is public knowledge. Would it be unprecedented for him to resign here in the president's second term, give the president an opportunity to fill another seat? What would it mean?
Yeah, I don't think it would be, do not think it would be unprecedented. And as you said, given the apparent very frail health of the Chief Justice, I guess it would not surprise me if there was some kind of an announcement at any time now. And Rehnquist has been on the court for some time. He's been Chief Justice since 86, so he's served admirably. And this would give at least some kind of a break for Bush to kind of nominate someone fairly early in his term. And given its Rehnquist seat and Rehnquist voting record, he tends to be fairly conservative and fairly pro-life. To me, it would be much easier for Bush to get someone like Rehnquist, or as Bush has said, a Scalia or Thomas, two other conservatives, someone like that, into that Rehnquist seat, whether it's for the Chief Justice or for an Associate Justice. Of course, the more interesting chapter would unfold if, say, hypothetically a Stevens or someone like that, a more liberal pro-choice justice, would resign. Stevens is the elder statesman on the court. And if Bush at that point were to try and nominate someone of a fairly conservative ilk, then there'd be some fireworks on Capitol Hill.
So if you were to take a guess now, let's assume that Rehnquist says in the next month, look, I'm sick. I need to devote myself to either getting better or this may be the end. I'm going to resign. Who is the most likely next Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, irrespective of who would replace or who would ascend to the court?
Yeah, there's been some speculation, and I'm not sure I buy this, but some speculation that Bush might try and elevate Justice Thomas to that. I think it's more likely if Bush were to go from within the existing Supreme Court, that he would tap a Scalia, Antonin Scalia, as an associate justice now, as the chief justice, and it seems to me he would be confirmed, I would think, fairly easily, given that some of his credentials are similar to Rehnquist, and he is a fairly respected legal mind, a brilliant mind in many circles.
Dr. Jeff Waltz is Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin. Thank you for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
When we come back, we're going to talk about Missouri and Illinois and legislation for pro-life causes.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Matthew's Gospel contains a lot of Jesus' teaching. But how do these long sections of teaching from our Lord relate to the end of Matthew's Gospel, where Matthew tells us about Jesus' suffering, death, and resurrection for a sinful world? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for January is called Discourses in Matthew by Dr. David Scare. Discourses in Matthew is $29.99 plus shipping and handling. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look under the What's New section for more information on the Issues, Etc. book of the month for January, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church by Dr. David Scare, or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for January, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church.
Gay marriage. Now, what's the answer? Answers with Ken Ham, author of the best-selling book, The Lie Evolution. Well, Ken, how can Christians in our increasingly secular Western cultures deal publicly with this issue of gay marriage?
Well, at a recent conference on the gay marriage issue, a prominent Christian leader told the audience that you shouldn't use the Bible in debating gay marriage. He said that the culture no longer listens to such biblical arguments. But the Bible is the Word of God. It's the only absolute authority we have in all matters of life and conduct. If Adam and Eve's creation and their marriage are literal history, only then do we have a basis for saying that marriage must be a man and a woman. Think about it. Ultimately, without the Bible, marriage could be anything you wanted it to be. The reason much of the culture won't listen to the arguments from the Bible is because they think that evolutionary ideas and the concept of millions of years of history have disproved the Bible's accuracy and historicity. Instead of saying that we can't use the Bible to argue against gay marriage, Christian leaders should be opposing anti-biblical evolutionary ideas, and then they need to explain to the world why the Bible's history in Genesis is true, thus establishing it can be trusted, including what it teaches about the origin of marriage. Then they can show why gay marriage is wrong.
Ken Ham shares much more about this controversial topic in his new booklet on gay marriage. It's available free on our website, AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Heinz Funky Purple Ketchup has been a big hit. Kelly Stitt, a senior marketing manager for Heinz, is not surprised. When asked about it, she replied, quote, "All our advertising is targeted to kids. You want that nag factor, so that 7-year-old Sarah is nagging mom in the store to buy Funky Purple," end quote. It is appalling that manufacturers use the media as a tool to manipulate our children for their own corporate profits. Our sons and daughters are more than mere consumers. They are redeemed children of God, saved by Jesus' suffering and death on the cross. Our children are to be loved, nurtured, and respected, not manipulated and used for financial gain. Do your children a big favor. Teach them to recognize and avoid such media manipulation. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Marriage without commitment will not succeed.
Kids, we feel, are different at birth.
The best way to improve your sex life might be to go help your wife with the dishes.
You can build a stable relationship.
I believe the wisdom comes from the scriptures, and it's been
solid words of guidance and encouragement from Dr. James Dobson on Focus on the Family. Heard weekdays right here.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
A couple of weeks ago, we did an open lines where we asked the question, if your son wanted to become a pastor, would you encourage him to do this, given, you know, the hardships that are entailed in becoming a pastor in the church? Or if your daughter wanted to marry a pastor, would you encourage them to do that? Now, you might know such a young man who wants to become a pastor, or you might want to encourage such a young man to at least look into what it means to become a pastor. To that end, let me tell you about the Christ Academy 2005 that's held on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, every year. It's a 2-week residential program for high school-aged men of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod who are interested or just kind of dabbling in the possibility of future studies for the pastoral ministry. This is a 2-week residential program. That means they go to class, they go to the chapel, they get to interact with the faculty, with existing students there. They get a chance to sort out all the questions that surround this decision that they're going to face, if not early on in their lives, then, of course, later. Now, for more information about Christ Academy 2005 at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, call them toll-free, 1-800-481-2155, or go to our website and click on the Christ Academy logo. You will find a direct link to everything you need to know about it, an application for the Academy, and frequently asked questions. Everything is there at that link at our website, issuesetc.org. That's issuesetc.org. If you have that young man in mind, in your church, in your congregation, in your family, wherever they are, just give them the website. Give them our website, issuesetc.org, and tell them, click on Christ Academy. And you know, you might be starting something with this young man, planting seed, wherein you will be encouraging a future pastor in the church. 1-800-481-2155 or our website, issuesetc.org. christacademy.org. Look for the Christ Academy 2005 logo. For the remainder of today's program, we're going to be talking with Bill Beckman about pro-life legislation in Illinois. He's executive director of Illinois Right to Life. And then in a few minutes, Pam Fichter of the president of Missouri Right to Life will join us to talk about pro-life legislation in Missouri. Bill is up first. Bill, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. Thank you very much.
Bill, your thoughts on this 32nd anniversary recently observed of Roe v. Wade?
Well, obviously, with every passing year, the tragedy just gets larger and larger. We're now up to approaching 46 million babies lost to abortion since 1973. As usual, there was a large turnout of people to demonstrate that the Supreme Court made a mistake in coming down with that decision. And the testimony of women who've had abortions and regretted them on the steps of the Supreme Court as well. So I think that it speaks to the need for the opportunity for George Bush to appoint some strict constructionists to our Supreme Court that will defend our right to life.
The Illinois scene, of course, is rather dismal if you're a pro-lifer. I'm a resident of Illinois, as you are as well, Bill. And you look at the governor's office, the Senate, the legislature, and just about every other venue of state government, it seems as though a very unfriendly place for the unborn. Am I painting too dark a picture?
Well, it certainly at this point in time is not an encouraging environment, especially not for getting any new legislation through the to become law. So that's certainly something that's a challenge that we face. One encouraging sign is we did have some pro-life victories in the last election, which demonstrate that anybody saying that you can't win with that viewpoint is clearly proven wrong election after election. And hopefully that will mean that for the future that there is opportunity, but it'll take some work.
What is on the agenda, if anything, for Illinois with regard to pro-life issues?
Could you ask that again? I'm sorry, I missed hearing.
What pro-life issues are on the agenda or could be on the agenda in the near future in Illinois?
Well, one of the things that we're looking at is that the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, which has already been passed at the federal level and actually got significant votes in the Senate from even very staunchly liberal members such as Kennedy. That failed in Illinois, and we don't feel that that made any sense. And apparently the excuse that's now been made was that it wasn't exactly the same as the federal wording. That is now being fixed for this legislative session that's just beginning, and we feel that we have a reasonable chance of moving that one through at least the House. And hopefully once if it does pass the House by an overwhelming margin, that the Senate will recognize that that's something that it would be politically unfeasible to oppose. So that would be a good piece of legislation to move through, and we think there's at least some possibility that it might actually make it to the governor's desk. We at this point do not know what the chances are that he would sign it, but if it was voted on by an overwhelming majority, he'd probably be forced to sign it.
How would you characterize Governor Blagojevich's position when it comes to the life issue?
He has been somewhat quiet of recent, though I guess he didn't need to make any views known because the legislative leaders have protected him from getting any pro-life bills to his desk. But based on statements that he made during the campaign and any indications that have come out, it seems that he's certainly strongly pro-abortion. And therefore we would anticipate that under most circumstances he would oppose and veto most any legislation that came to his desk that was of the pro-life variety.
I'd like your reaction. This is from a story from the Illinois section of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch recently under the headline, Abortion Fight Expands to Other Issues. Very, very late in the story, a quote from Sally Burgess, who is the director of the Granite City Hope Clinic for Women, one of the region's major abortion providers, of course.
Mm-hmm.
She said that she was pleased that, quote, a good, solid pro-choice majority is running the state of Illinois. Your reaction?
obviously we are on the exact opposite side of that, and we feel that there has been some movement to whittle that down. Though I mean, clearly they still have a majority, and effectively, other than the bill that I mentioned, it's very unlikely that we're going to manage to get other bills through. But we are intending to submit other bills, such as a ban on human cloning, a woman's right to know, and these are, again, things that we feel are, things that at a minimum need to be debated, and we're hoping that at a minimum that we can get them out of committee and have them debated. But that's a tough, because a lot of times they're assigned to a very hostile committee and they can't even get out to the floor for a debate.
It sounds as though some of that legislation is familiar to our Missouri listeners who have seen it both put forward and passed and signed in Missouri. To what degree is Illinois hoping to follow Missouri's lead as much as it can?
Well, certainly, I mean, we already know that there are a number of pro-life bills that have passed in states surrounding us, and we feel that we need to catch up. We know that those bills do contribute to a reduction in abortions. We are fortunate that in the last reporting year that we did have a reduction in abortions by 10% in Illinois. And so we feel that there's a lot of potential if we could pass such legislation, such as woman's right to know and parental consent and that kind of thing, that we would have a significant reduction in abortions. But we obviously are being denied that opportunity right now based on the current construction of the Illinois legislature.
Bill, can you tell us, do you know of anyone who's in the bullpen for the midterm elections to hopefully at least make a beginning at changing the pro-life complexion of Illinois at the state level?
Well, I think at this point no specific names are on the tip of my tongue. I mean, I know that we've had some people that have, previously made attempts, and I think that given the right circumstances that they may have more opportunities in the future. I think that we've got an environment now where there's at least some contention going on among the Democrats themselves, some infighting, and effectively that at least creates the potential opportunity for people who recognize that those are not the issues that our citizens are concerned with to bring to the forefront of their minds other things and recognize that maybe that there's opportunities for other candidates. But I don't know that at this point in time we've got any guarantees that we're going to have those right candidates in the right places. But certainly Andy McKinnon is now the leader for the Republican Party in Illinois, and he's certainly been a friend of life, and we're hoping that with his guidance that maybe we can focus on the right things and make a difference in the future campaigns.
Bill Beckman is Executive Director of Illinois Right to Life. Bill, thank you very much for being our guest.
Todd, you're very welcome. Thank you.
You know, this is discouraging for me, to be quite honest with you, as an Illinois resident I didn't know when I moved into Illinois that this was the situation in the pro-life community. Of course, I know it in spades now, but what it does is present a challenge to pro-lifers in Illinois. The basic kind of grassroots challenge that really faces people who are in a life-friendly state like Missouri as well. And that is to understand the situation, as dim as it may seem, to understand the situation at your local level and to start planting the seeds of a pro-life change in the state of Illinois. The website for Illinois Right to Life is Illinois Right to Life, all one word, illinoisrighttolife.org, illinoisrighttolife.org. For the remainder of today's program, Pam Fichter is our guest. She's president of Missouri Right to Life. We're going to talk about some pro-life legislation in Missouri. Pam, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. Nice to be with you.
Pam, what's your general thought here on the 32nd anniversary of Roe v. Wade?
Well, I think it's a very, very sad day. I remember when I first heard that Roe v. Wade had passed and got on the phone immediately and calling people to see if they had heard and to find out what we could do about it. And I remember talking to my pastor at the time, and he said, this isn't going to stand. He said, as soon as people find out what this did, there's no way that this is going to be tolerated. And yet here we are, 32 years later and 45 million abortions later. But again, I take heart from today. I know that there are hundreds of thousands of people in Washington, D.C., being a witness to the tragedy of a legalized abortion on demand in our country. And, you know, God bless them for being there. I've been there on numerous occasions. It's a very inspiring event to participate in because it just helps you come together with so many good pro-life people and to be able to have this this large public witness opposing abortion in our land on this date, I think is very heartening. Also, we're very encouraged that the polling numbers show that people are becoming more and more pro-life. There have been studies that show that that our children are more pro-life than our generation is, and I just think that's very promising.
So, is it safe to say that Missouri is a state is emerging as a leader among the 50 states in passing pro-life legislation?
Missouri, we've had tremendous success in Missouri, and you know we've had success in Missouri even when we haven't had a pro-life governor because we've overturned you know governor's vetoes of pro-life legislation. But you know the work goes on. You know we have some important legislative priorities for this year and we're working very hard to educate people and to get support for these bills and you know to pave the way to get them passed. We have the largest pro-life bipartisan majority in Jefferson City that we've ever had. 79% of our Senate is considered to be pro-life and over 70% of the Missouri House is considered to be pro-life. So we have you know Missouri citizens have let their voices be heard with their ballots, and they have voted for a majority of pro-life people, and so we're very very gratified by that, and very optimistic that that's going to help us be successful with some good pro-life legislation.
Sam Lee was quoted in Saturday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch talking about a backlog of legislation in the Missouri State House that has kind of been piling up with previous pro-choice governors. What's in the backlog? What's coming up?
Well, I don't know that it's a backlog. We always have a lot of good pro-life legislation that we want to see go through, and of course, it's always a bigger obstacle when you have a governor that you're pretty certain is going to veto everything. So it does limit what you can plan on doing because then you have to always plan for an override. We're a little more optimistic with this governor, although we do have some concerns on his position on human cloning, and of course, that's our most important legislation. You know, we feel that this is an issue that has a momentum all of its own. This technology that is being promoted all over the country, and you know, the false promises that are being made about it, and the lack of education that's out there on the true nature of it, you know, is a big obstacle for us. But that's our most important bill. But we also have some other very good pieces of legislation, and then of course, you know, when you have this many pro-life legislators, they have a lot of great ideas of their own, and, you know, Missouri Right to Life is there to support our legislators as they advance their own pro-life legislation and to help them in any way that we can. Last year, we followed 45 bills. So, you know, it's a big job, but when you've got this many pro-life people, it's a very welcome task to be able to have a lot of pro-life bills to be working on.
The president of Planned Parenthood for the St. Louis region is quoted in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch talking about a bill that would allow Missouri schools to teach abstinence only in their sex education curriculum, and they, of course, plan to oppose this. Tell us about this.
I'm not as familiar with that piece of legislation, Todd. I believe that's Cynthia Davis's bill, and I'm not as familiar with that one, I'm sorry to say.
Okay, so if you were to say, okay, here's our agenda, and make it maybe a top two or three, what does the pro-life agenda for 2005 and beyond look like now in Missouri?
Well, the most important bill that we have, and frankly the bill that we consider to be the most important piece of pro-life legislation to ever be considered at the state level, is the ban on human cloning. We have 18 co-sponsors of this bill in the Senate. It's Senate Bill 160. The main sponsor of the bill is Senator Matt Bartles from Kansas City area. And again, we've got a total of 18 co-sponsors on this bill. We're going to have a hearing coming up on it the end of the month. And we also have Representative Jim Lemke from South County, South St. Louis County, is also working on a bill that will be introduced later that would be the same bill in the House. And we're looking for a lot of co-sponsors of that. And certainly would encourage anyone who's listening to this program to contact their state senator and their state representative and urge them to sign on to these bills as co-sponsors and also urge their support of these bills.
Now, these bills come in various varieties, as you well know, Pam, and some of them claim to be bans on human cloning when, in fact, they're clone and kill bills. They're permission to clone,
right,
but require the death of the human embryo created through human cloning. Is that true of this bill?
This bill bans the procedure known as somatic cell nuclear transfer, and that is the method of cloning that was used to clone Dolly the sheep. The Missouri Right to Life supports the ethical research on adult stem cells, but we oppose the research that involves the destruction of a human embryo, and we oppose the method of cloning human beings that is being currently promoted to produce these embryonic embryos so that they can harvest their stem cells. And so our bill is a very comprehensive bill that would ban all cloning, not just the reproductive cloning. I mean, you know, quite frankly, to ban reproductive cloning, you know, that allows a human being to be cloned and brought right up to the moment of birth, and it allows the destruction of that human being at any point until that time. So we would certainly oppose that very aggressively. Our bill opposes all human cloning.
You're certainly aware that in the last election, the state of California voted to permit about $3 billion of state money to go toward cloning research, and that was kind of a step in favor of saying they want to have the biotech industry in their state. They want that money coming in for stem cell research, even if it means the destruction of human embryos. And how do you respond to someone who says, you know, Missouri's cutting itself out of a lot of potential money by passing a bill that would totally ban human cloning?
Well, first of all, we can't justify for economic reasons the destruction of human life at any point for any reason, but you know, the economic hammer that is being held over Missouri's head with this hasn't proven true in other states. In Michigan, that banned cloning, after the cloning ban, the biotech industry there has just exploded. They have 70 new biotech companies there after the cloning ban. You know, I find it very, very strange that people don't question, you know, this is not illegal, and yet none of the private money is going towards embryonic stem cell research, because they haven't had any successful applications. The private money is all going to adult stem cell research. But, you know, when the biotech people are promoting the embryonic stem cells, they don't make the distinction between the two types of stem cells. And I think that's one of the great disservices that that's done, especially in California. I think they were sold a bill of goods out there that embryonic stem cell research is going to be the cure-all, when there hasn't been any successful research, in spite of the fact that private money has never been illegal to invest in that.
Former Senator and soon-to-be former Attorney General of the U.S., John Ashcroft, is going into retirement. Has anyone talked to him about stepping up here in Missouri and becoming a spokesman for the life issues here in Missouri, given his roots?
Well, that's a great idea. I don't know that we have, but I think that would be a wonderful idea. We'll certainly pursue that. You know, we have a great pro-life organization in the state of Missouri, and we have some great pro-life voices here, and we would certainly welcome his involvement.
Pam Fichter is president of Missouri Right to Life. Pam, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you.
You hear it at the end of the program quite often when we talk about life issues. You're defending life from beginning to end. It's one of the things that we try to do here at Issues, etc. And it's something that we have taken as a serious pillar and plank of what we do day to day, week in, week out for you here on Issues, etc. Help us defend life from beginning to end by joining our monthly donor program. We have three levels for our donors. One is the confessor. The other, the apologist, and the third, the reformer. It's the Issues, Etc. Reformation Club. At the first level, the confessor, $25 a month, or an annual gift of $250. At the level of the apologist, it's $50 a month, or a one-time gift of $500. And then at the level of the reformer, $100 a month, or an annual gift of $1,000. If you'd like more information on the benefits of becoming a member of the Issues, Etc. Reformation Club as a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer, just go to our website, issuesetc, www.theatheist.org and look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Issuesetc.org. We reached our goal of 100 easily. At the end of 2004, we actually came out with 107 by year's end. Our new goal is 125 Reformation Club members by Easter. It's just a couple months away, and we're looking for another 25 members of the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses, or you can write us at Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. It's a way to donate. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Also, our resource line is always open, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. If you're thinking of, it's tax time, if you're thinking about laying the foundation for some charitable giving here as you're filling out your taxes for 2005, Issues Etc. would appreciate you remembering us and becoming a member of the Issues Etc. Reformation Club as a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer. 1-800-737-0172, issuesetc.org, or Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, by Easter, we hope to have 125 members of the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Tomorrow on the program, national pro-life legislation. Doug Johnson of National Right to Life will give us the big picture after our conversations here with Bill Beckman and Pam Fichter. What is awaiting the signature of presidents? What is awaiting the vote of our congressmen and our senators when it comes to pro-life legislation at the national level? Also, we're going to be talking about the conversion of St. Paul. Dr. Peter Scare of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, will be our guest. Now, I've asked several guests already here in the course of our conversation just today their thoughts on 32 years of decriminalized abortion. What are my thoughts? It's very easy to become discouraged. There are two great dangers, I think. One is to become discouraged and say, after 32 years, this thing's set in stone. Well, it may be. But have you ever seen how even the most hardy edifice made of the hardest stone is worn away over time, eroded over time? That may be all the more we can hope for Roe v. Wade. That's better than nothing. The other danger, and I think it's even a greater danger, is in the pro-life community simply to satisfy ourselves with cheerleading. That's not what we're doing here at Issues Etc. Rather than cheerleading pro-life cause, we are attempting to genuinely defend life from beginning to end. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.